Welcome back to New Books in Native American Studies. I'm Andrew Epstein, and thanks for listening to this podcast for the New Books Network. Each episode, we pick a recently published work in Native American and Indigenous Studies and spend the hour speaking with the author. First off, my sincere apologies for listeners who've been waiting since late last year for another episode. But as we finally head to the end of this academic year, I hope I can resume a more regular pace. Today, I'm joined by Alejandra Dubkowski, and in a first for our podcast, we talked in person in her office on the campus of Yale University earlier this week. That's because I'm a graduate student here, and Alejandra is assistant professor in the Department of History. Receiving her PhD from the University of California, Berkeley in 2011, Professor Dubkowski has published articles in Ethnohistory, the William and Mary Quarterly, Native South, and other places. But it's her incredible new book, just out from Harvard University Press, that we discussed. Informed Power, Communication in the Early American South, takes us deep into a world many of us will find unfamiliar and asks some unique and provocative questions. This region lacked a regular mail system or even a single printing press until the 1730s, two centuries after the first forays of the Spanish Empire. But this was no uninformed backwater. Indigenous peoples hailing from a multitude of nations who overwhelmingly outnumbered settlers well into the 18th century blazed trails, sent out couriers, marked trees and stones, selectively passed messages between competing empires, and engaged in methods sometimes ingenious, other times wholly accidental, to establish themselves as central actors in a diverse and often violent world. I hope you enjoy our discussion. Welcome, Professor Dubkowski, to the very first in-person podcast interview for New Books in Native American Studies. We usually conduct these interviews at great geographical distance, sometimes relying on intercontinental communication networks. But because we are both at Yale University, we get to do this in person, an ironic fact for a discussion about information traveling over great and uncertain distances. I want to start where you do in Informed Power, with the Stono Rebellion in September of 1739. Historians of the colonial South are quite familiar with this uprising of enslaved African people in the colony of South Carolina. We know the story, a group of slaves near Charlestown revolt, kill about 20 white people, destroy several plantations, head south for Spanish Florida, and are all caught. But you ask a question that really should have occurred to people a long time ago, and when you ask it on page one, it's like, right, of course, which is, how the heck did the slaves know to march south? And how did they know if they reached Spanish Florida, they would be free? So you can answer those questions, but I'm also just curious how you came to ask that type of question, because I think it's central to your project here.
Thank you so much, Andrew. And thank you for, it's really nice to be talking to you in person about communication and personal face-to-face communication as well. So the story I begin and the book I begin with that question of how the heck did these slaves know to go south? And I had this striking suspicion that it wasn't their masters who were telling them, you know, if you just walk 250 miles south, you're going to be free. So if it wasn't them, how is it that the slaves knew to march south? So that question actually began because I was trying to do a project on colonial South Carolina, on the Stono Rebellion itself, trying to understand violent forms of resistance. And I am not from South Carolina. Mm-hmm. I do not know South Carolina. Actually, I knew very little of the American South. So I just kept putting maps up on my wall just to figure out where, you know, where Berkeley County was, where, you know, Stono was, or all these places. And I just was very struck by the movement of people, how much people were moving, how much they seemed to know about places that on the map looked really far away. So it was really a question that came out of not at all knowing the region that forced me to ask a seemingly simple question that pushed me really farther back in time and into Native history and into places and spaces that I was really unfamiliar with. And really to answer that question of how did this group of slaves know about Spanish Florida in 1739 really opened the conversation of actually, how does anyone know anything in the colonial world? So that's how it was a really small question that opened up a much larger problem in colonial America.
And I'm guessing the answer is Google Maps on your smartphone.
completely. Right. Google Maps, I wish, I mean, I think they wished, but I think that gets to the question of, you know, what are the mediums that are available for people to know anything in the colonial world? And the assumptions that I had was that no one knew anything in colonial America, that they like operated with tiny limited versions of information and just had to make decisions knowing almost nothing. And it turns out that that's not true. People knew a great deal. I mean, they didn't have Google Maps. They didn't know how far away some places were. But they did know far more than we know when we sort of assume that they know. And they made very smart decisions with the knowledge that they had. It was imperfect. They had to. It was ever-changing. It was dynamic. All the sort of things we associate with information today in many ways, that it's sort of overwhelming and vast. But that's sort of the same kind of problems they had. They had to know a great deal about a great many things and had to figure out how to sort it and put it in order. So for slaves to know about Spanish Florida, they had to sort of know about Indian paths that connected them to Spanish Florida. They had to know something about Spanish. They had to know about sort of the relationship to Spanish and the English. So it just, to know these little facts, these like layers upon layers of what people had to begin to understand of this world becomes sort of visible. And that was really exciting to me, not about how one particular news or item traveled, but how people became informed and made sense of their world.
So the colonial South, before the middle of the 18th century, is an unfamiliar world for many of us, maybe most of us, maybe the overwhelming majority of us. Part one of Informed Power is titled Making Sense of La Florida, 1560s to 1670s. So I'm hoping you can help us out a little, and just kind of introduce us to this region before 1560. How do you characterize it? What Indian peoples are living there? And then finally, what brings European empires here?
So the early South, I mean, this is an exciting world filled with people and filled with Native people who we know little about. And I often joke with my students when I lecture about this part of the world that I call them the ungoogleable Indians, because even if you Google them today, you find nothing. And that really tends to shock my students that if you Google Ispo, you come up with nothing. Like they, surely we can't know anything about them if Google doesn't render me this information. But that gets to the idea that these are not even names we recognize. When I say Creeks, many of us have sort of some semblance of who the Creeks even are today, or some idea of removal. But when I say Tumukwa, or when I say Wale, or when I say Calusa, I get sort of some strange looks. And when I say study Florida and I don't study the Seminoles, it's even sort of just more shocking, this idea that I'm studying an earlier moment and period in time. So I think I'm with these people. This is a strange sort of world that we need to, there's still so much work that needs to make sense of it. The story, you can begin as earlier in time as you want. I keep going back earlier and earlier. The book itself sort of begins with Cahokia to ground a little bit of the Mississippian chiefdoms and sort of hierarchical societies and very large organized society that existed before European contact, but not to really focus on 900, but to focus on the period before European colonization, to begin to understand what's going on in North America before Ponce de Leon makes it to Florida. And I think for me, that's important, not just to say, look, Native people were here and they had a history, which of course they do, but to understand that these complexities that these Native people have are going to just shape the way colonization is going to happen or not happen in certain areas. So I think laying that groundwork, although it might seem like, why is she taking us back so far in time, is really to show that these layers, that in my case, that these paths are sort of instrumental. So who I'm talking about primarily are groups in present-day Florida. These are Tumukwa, Wale, and Apalache Indians, and some Indians in southern Florida, the Ai and Calusa, Tocoba. I mean, there's just a wider range of people and smaller groups within those groups themselves. So these are just and there's a large number of people. I mean, Tumukwa, this is always a question we want to have. How many people are there before European colonization? But the numbers seem huge. They're in the hundreds of thousands, especially of Tumukwa. So these are large, large native polities, native groups that have many different languages and many different forms of dealing with each other, not always peaceful, not always, you know. So I think it's a really complicated native space before the Europeans arrive and begin giving us records for it. One of my most fascinating little tidbits of information that comes from this is that in 1513, which is when Ponce de Leon sails to Florida, searching for the Fountain of Youth. Not really. He wasn't looking for the Fountain of Youth. That comes later in imaginations of his voyage. But when he gets there, he encounters Indians that already speak Spanish. This is 1513. This is before Cortez goes to Mexico. This is before the Incas. This is so.
How is that possible?
From Cuba and Hispaniola. Right. So native people are moving in these spaces and communicating with each other, telling them about the Spanish, and also picking up these languages.
And that's barely 20 years after Columbus.
Yeah. So this is like a world that's sort of even before sort of official the settling of Spanish St. Augustine and the establishing of St. Augustine in 1565. You have sort of voyages into the southeast by the Spanish. You have Ponce de León. Briefly, he barely makes it inland in either of his voyages. But then you have these really large expeditions into Florida. You have Hernando de Soto that goes in with 800 people. I mean, these are huge expeditions that march through the region. You have the Tristan da Luna, the site that has just recently been found, like last year, which is the big gap in the historiography. He goes in 1559, and he takes 2,000 people. I mean, these are gigantic expeditions that the Spanish are sending, and they all fail miserably. And perhaps the most famous one is Panfilo de Narváez, who goes with Cabeza de Vaca. And because Cabeza de Vaca leaves this great diary of his expedition, we know. But so there are these like continual voyages into Florida, these efforts to conquer and figure out this region. And they all fail just miserably, and they find no gold. So you have these very large expeditions in the 16th century that just seem to kill everyone. So Florida just seems like an awful place to go. That's not going to attract any European ventures into it. And then the French set up shop, and that just really changes everything for the Spanish.
You write at some point that Florida was a magnet for destruction, failure, and death. But people kept coming.
People kept coming. And I think part of that is the lore that they could, you know, now we know that there was no next Aztec empire that was waiting. But if you think about it, they didn't know there was going to be a next Aztec empire. And then they found the Incas, you know, the Spanish. So, I mean, there's the idea that if they could find the Aztec empire with all this gold, if they could find the Inca, why not a third? You know, this is not a sort of crazy logic. And Hernando de Soto goes there in 1540. So it's right there in the midst of all this. So there's the idea that there could be more. And there's also the strategic location of Florida. Sort of every ship that's sailing away from the Caribbean back to Europe needs to pass through Florida. So having an outpost in this coast is very advantageous, and it's also really good because it's really dangerous water, so lots of ships tend to just not make it past the Gulf Coast. So also it's a great site to wreck ships that have just not made it through, so to save survivors, more importantly, save the loot that was from the ships. So Florida has this strategic position that everyone sort of recognizes, but the fact that there's no sort of monetary gain that can be gained immediately, and especially when you have silver mines and gold coming out from Mesoamerica, there's no real want for Florida. But when the French set up a colony there, a really short-lived, disastrous colony, I think that really prompts the Spanish to say, no, there's really nothing there for us, but we don't want the other guys.
Yeah. And it was always, I mean, it wasn't about setting up plantations or some sort of extractive industry.
I think they tried. The La Luna expedition, I think, really tries. I mean, 2,000 people. I mean, this is a different kind of venture than we sort of imagine the conquistadors there. They're going with families. They're going there to plant. It just, they get hit by a hurricane within like the first month. They get all wiped out. They can't find food. That fails so miserably that they never send enough. They never send enough people back to Florida ever again. I mean, I think at its height, Florida has, in the period that I'm sending, 1,500 people. I mean, this is a tiny, that's the thing always to remember, that this is a tiny European outpost from which we have most of the records, because these are European sources, in an entirely native controlled space. So although the sources come from there and I can help as a historian create the story from the outpost, for me, it's imperative to remember that this is a tiny blip in a much larger world.
Well, this is something I wanted to ask you about too, because I was in hearing you talk about your book before reading it, I was remembering something that I heard Peter Wood once say about how he came to write Black Majority on slavery and colonial South Carolina, which was, you know, I think it was a dissertation in the 60s in Margaret. And he was just like, I looked at the demographics, and there's a story there. There were more Black people than white people.
Absolutely.
That's a story. And it seems like you had a similar realization here, too, when you compare these strips of settler populations to a vast indigenous world.
Yeah.
What was that sort of process for you to come to that, and how did that change your project?
It's funny because I read Peter Wood. I read actually not just The Black Majority, but his Powhatan's Mantle with the demography. And that just really, that really blew my mind. I mean, I think because as historians, we're trained to read documents. That's what I'm trained to do. I was reading Spanish-produced and English-produced sources describing their efforts. And I guess I knew that they were Native people. I wasn't sort of blind, but I'm reading their voices through them. So really, it really takes a moment and a deep breath to think about, wait, I am reading through them, but all they're describing is not actually in their control or even in their influence. This is all sort of Native control spaces. And actually, you don't have to read that hard to begin finding those things. It's sort of amazing to me when you see it. It's like everywhere. You cannot unsee Native people once you begin to see them, that they're really everywhere. And at least for the Spanish, because they don't set up in Florida, they don't set up settlement, they set up missions. The centrality of Native people is key, because they're not there to missionize Spanish colonists. They're there to missionize Native people. Mm-hmm. So in the main Spanish effort in Florida, which are these missions, all they're there to do in theory is to interact with Native people and convert them and the like. But so all these records are about who these Native people are, you know, from lists of with names. I mean, the Spanish are great because they record names, they record all these things. So it really, I mean, it's very hard not. I mean, you can tell a story about the missionizing effort, but who they're thinking about what they're doing gets us to think about the Native people.
So you write, I think you're writing in this moment on the pre-colonial world, but it has applications once we get into this kind of competition of empires, that that by focusing on the modes and techniques that Indians developed to acquire and spread information, we can see a world that was not only intricately connected, but also incredibly dynamic. And I was just wondering if you could give us a couple examples of those modes and techniques in the pre-colonial world that persist, or and then also how you figured that out. There are no documentary records before, as you say, European outposts. So what are some of these modes?
So that's, you know, I always want to know, like, what were they talking about? Yeah, and I'm not going to have any records for that. So there's some ways to do this. I do this by looking at, for example, at paths, and looking at which paths are, how are paths maintained? Because it struck me when I was reading De Soto or reading any of the early Spanish documents from the 16th century, that oftentimes they say, you know, we're completely lost in the wilderness. And it became clear to me, I could discern the moments when they were truly lost and the moments where they were just complaining. And it became really clear because when they made progress, they were actually on a Native path. Mm. And when they were just not making, when they were like not traveling more than like a mile every day.
They were just walking right into the woods.
They were in the swamps, you know, they were not. So it became very clear that there were these paths that were clearly maintained, whether European eyes were seeing them or not, they were there. And often they remark about how Native people kept these paths open. I mean, there's lots of indications of painting paths red as a way to show that these paths are closed. I mean, there are these graphic moments in which the Spanish encounter Spanish bodies dug up and put alongside the path as a way to say, this path is closed. And there's lots of indications that sort of similar ways of painting paths red existed pre-Spanish entradas, and also making them open, putting food offerings, showing that peace, not war, sort of welcome. So that's sort of a way to see what people were doing in the maintaining of this path. And also, you know, when you look at the archaeological record, things like the burying of war clubs, you know, when you see people buried alongside military weapons. Well, on the one hand, that tells you that militarization was something that was deeply valued if you're going to be buried along with that artifact. And when you see also that coupled with graves that have more and more traumatic death and causes of death that are all violent induced, you start seeing, okay, violence and war and communicating that becomes a very clear thing. So I find it not in a written word, because I don't have things from Cahokia that are written down, but in reactions to events or like the building of palisades and forts. You only build a fort if something is going to be attacked. So there are ways in which you can read sort of backwards and forwards from the sources themselves. And then it's in these really early documents in the 1500s where the Spanish for the first time are seeing these Native communities and commenting upon the practices, then assuming these practices are in effect before, you know, that this is not the first time they manifest themselves, counting sticks, you know, there's moments of knots as a way to keep track of time. There's all these sort of little things that the Spanish sort of note that Native people are doing to interact with one another.
Hmm. And so once you have this world formerly part of an imperial competition in some ways. You mentioned the French try to set up shop briefly. It changes how the Spanish relate to that place. And then some decades later, British colonies, at least in the Carolinas.
Yeah.
this maybe is a big question because it's essentially a whole part of your book, but, you know, what role, if you can generalize or maybe give a couple examples, do Indigenous peoples who are in this dynamic networked world play in that imperial competition?
Yeah. So, I mean, physically, they're right in the middle, right? So the English set up in South Carolina in 1670. According to this imperial treaty, they're supposed to be non-aggressive partners to one another. That does not last for like a second. The English and the Spanish are in perpetual war with one another in the South. And Native people smack down in the middle of these spaces in what will become Georgia play an instrumental role in sort of linking these groups together and letting the Spanish know about the English and the English know about the Spanish. And also what was striking to me, it wasn't just that. Like I can tell you great anecdotes of sort of Native informers. I have a great moment about this particular cacique who plays sort of a dual role, the cacique of Pabini, who goes back and forth informing the Spanish about things. She's a fantastic character, I think, super understudied and everywhere in the sources. She appears from 1670 to 1672, just 2 years in the Spanish sources. She's a chiefess of this group that really seems to have come together right at this moment. And the way she's able to retain the autonomy of her people is really by using information. She says to the Spanish, I can tell you about the English if you sort of protect me. And she tells the English, I can tell you about the Spanish if you sort of provide me goods. And for about 2 years, she's able to play both sides off each other, which is sort of this sort of great moment in a moment of time where most of the towns in Georgia are either being attacked or relocating. She's able to sort of retain that autonomy. And it seems very small and brief, but it's actually quite impressive. And she uses the only thing she has basically at her disposal, which is sort of because she's in the middle, to parlay with both sides and able to retain that. But I think to me what's most striking is not just that that the Spanish and the English are using Native peoples as informers, is that they depend on Native people to tell them about other Europeans. I think that was, for me, it's just shocking that to learn about the English, the Spanish have to talk to Indians. That to learn about the Spanish, the English have to talk to Indians. So it's like Indians are telling Europeans about other Europeans. That to me is just sort of mind-blowing about how this world was going to be interacting with each other. And that also that it's not permanent, that this association of Indians with news is something that's always very tense and always up for sort of negotiation. In 1678, I have this moment where the South Carolina governor encounters a group of Indians and asks them about the Spanish. And then a European trader says, no, I can tell you about him in better detail. And so these Indians are pushed aside. And so there's this moment where Native people who are in the middle are seen as, wait, our role was to be the informers, and here we're being pushed aside. And they're going to fight for that ability to retain being informers, because that allows them to have power between the Spanish and the English. But that this is not a given category, that this is always up for grabs, who has the best information and how they can use that. So I think the presence of the English just adds another dimension and also pushes a lot of Native people who did not want to be missionized, who had stayed away from the Spanish sphere of influence, into contact with another European power. So you have groups like the Creeks, you have groups like the Yamasee, who had some contact with the Spanish, but it was very tepid, now really entering into sort of a colonial encounter that they had sort of not had until the 1670s.
Are you able to find examples of Native informers or communicators or who are influencing, changing, manipulating the information they receive from one colonial power and what they're delivering to another in such a way that benefits them?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, I talked about the Cacique Mamini, but this is one thing she does. I think even before her, there are these Indians, or the Port Royal Indians, who are telling the Spanish, oh, you shouldn't come north. You shouldn't come anywhere near South Carolina. The English are just super fierce. If you come near them, they're gonna kill you. You just stay where you are. And basically, other Indians are like, no, there's like 300, you know, English. They're just telling you that because they don't want you anywhere. You know, so there's lots of moments where misinformation as well as information gets played. And Native people are very aware that this is something that they have, that they can control. And often because eyewitness information is so privileged, the ability of someone to travel and have seen the settlement or have seen the little European hub firsthand is so valued. And the Spanish are not doing that. They're relying on Native people to do that, and vice versa. The English are not making all the way to St. Augustine. They're depending on that. So it's up for grabs what they choose to describe. Mm-hmm.
And you say, and you can already see the seeds in this of what you're describing, that an information race develops. You have a chapter called The Information Race. What do you mean by that?
Oh, that was I often call it the chapter that no one will read because it's like a case study, but I love it. It was one of my favorite chapters to write, because that's like chronicling the stories of the three powers, the French, the Spanish, and the English, to make sense of the region that's not the coast, basically, to make sense of not the coastal area, but what the Spanish are calling La Tierra Adentro, which literally just means the land inside. That's what they call basically everything that's not the coast, what the French are beginning to call, you know, the greater Louisiana, and what the English are calling the backcountry, and what Appalachians are calling their home. So, you know, it's to make sense of this region. They understand that they need to know what the heck it is, where it is, where are the paths, where are the towns. They don't know anything. And this is late. This is 1700s, and they're still figuring this out. So when we're confused about this world, I take comfort in that they were confused about that. They being the Europeans are confused about this world. So this information race becomes an effort to figure out who's going to be their allies, which are the paths that they're going to be able to travel in a reliable, functional way. And the Spanish are watching sort of South Carolina influence in the region. And part of the influence is because they're coming with better European goods to trade. They're coming with guns that they're willing to trade that the Spanish are never willing to trade. The Spanish never trade guns. They have very limited guns, but they also don't trade them with Native people. And the English don't come trying to missionize Native people. So it's a different kind of relationship that they forge with them. So you have South Carolina trying to make it past the coastal groups, trying to expand into the creeks, trying to expand, get some influence with the Chickasaws, maybe even the Choctaws. And the Spanish are trying to block that in any way, shape that they can. And they've try missionization and they try sending someone to figure out. And so you see two competing strategies going to the exact same towns. So this is an amazing moment where the Spanish, this horrible Spanish lieutenant who just makes one incompetent decision after the other, who gets to a town and gets greeted by a letter written in English by Woodward saying like, na, 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 you missed me. Better luck next time. And it's this incredible moment of you just seeing like how valued these little towns, these seemingly small towns are to these empires to try to figure out what this world is and what they can do in it.
Hmm. I want to ask a sort of unrelated question about the historiography of this region. Mm-hmm. I'm not deeply familiar with it, but certain sort of heuristic devices have bubbled up in the literature, a shatter zone, mm-hmm. ethnogenesis, the Indians' New World. I'm wondering if any of those kind of terms or concepts speak to you in the world that you're seeing. The one I really was curious about was the shatter zone. Mm-hmm. This idea that when the Spanish and other colonial empires came in and the slave trade started, you had just destruction, chaos, and then the sort of seeds of ethnogenesis. But does this speak to you, that sort of literature?
I mean, I think this is Robbie Etheridge, and her work is so, so instrumental. I mean, it's always like, you're so glad those books exist, and you're like, thank goodness someone did that book, that work for me. I can just, she wrote it for me. She doesn't know this, but she really did. But no, those terms really clearly speak to me. The reason I hesitate with information, because what I was seeing is I was seeing destruction and violence. And actually, the more work I keep doing on the Indian slave trade, the more I'm sort of trying to wrap my head around the incredible level of violence. And this violence is spreading far wider than we have chronicled today. So I'm very persuaded that this is an incredibly violent moment of time that disrupts all these things that had been in play before. That being said, a lot of paths are kept up during this disruptive moment. A lot of communication networks don't change. So there's a lot of sort of, there's another story, I think, that's not just destruction, but how people sort of negotiate that. And I don't mean just by ethnogenesis or by coming together in new sort of forms or coalescing into newer politics or forming new identities, but so how they're preserving things that had worked in the past, sort of avenues of power at play. So I think for me, I see that definitely, and I don't think I dispute it at all. I think it serves me kind of well that people have said this is an incredibly disruptive and violent moment of time. And I think for me, what's interesting is, well, how do people make sense of the world as that is going on? And for me, sort of the Yamasee War that comes towards the very end of my book, in 1715, this massive war that happens in South Carolina, where Yamasees and Lower Creeks sort of push to the breaking point in their relationships with the English, wage a war against them. What you're able to see is how important these communication networks are in them organizing the war and in them attacking. So they really strategically attack every English node that they can. So the English begin waging a war in the dark. But that shows me that by 1715, these things are still at play, even though they've undergone so much trauma and reorganization. People have retained sort of key nodes of power, and key towns have become sort of have retained sort of that. So I think even say this world's shattering apart, so I don't shy away from that at all. But I keep wondering, you know, sort of what is not what is the violence that's being inflicted on Native people, but how Native people are dealing with it. I think that to me is a more for me because Robbie has done this amazing work. I get to ask that other question: how Native people then deal with it.
Talking about the field still a little bit about where it might go.
Yeah.
One thing that I think is so incredible about this book and work in this field is that, you know, I think for a lot of us who work on later centuries, there's this kind of fast-forwarding effect that happens with the 16th century in particularly, but also the 17th century.
No!
But I mean, to some degree. But then you stop and think about the gaps in time between Columbus, the first, you know, incursions into this world, the first attempts at proper settlement, the first permanent settlements, and then a long time, and then more settlements. I mean, this is we're talking on the scale of centuries.
Centuries, yeah.
Centuries. And centuries that are, in the historical imagination, for many people, empty, besides these dates that stick out.
Yeah.
St. Augustine, Jamestown, Georgia, whatever.
Yeah.
Yamasee War, hopefully, right?
Hopefully.
Hopefully, not even.
Yeah.
So, as you've done so much work to make this blank space denser, where do you think things are going in this field?
I mean, for me, I always keep hoping that it gets even. I mean, for me, I'm like, oh no, I've done centuries. There's so much work in each of these little sections that could be done. Of course, we see this in our sources. I'm hoping there's a lot. There's so much Spanish language sources on these Native peoples that we know so little about that we could know so much more. I mean, they have the most sort of robust Native language materials that we have available for this, and there's almost no work done on them. I think now the University of Florida is going to digitize a collection that's also translations of these sources. So I'm really hopeful that sort of Spanish paleography is hard. 16th century hand is awful. But I think the fact that some of these things are going to go up online and they're going to be translations of the actual documents, I think it's going to help sort of open that and show just the breadth of that field. So I'm hoping more exploration will come and sort of in earlier centuries as well. I'm hoping, I mean, I've seen that sort of Native field in Native history begin to do biographies of Native people. There's a biography of Mary Musgrove, which is fantastic, but to think more about getting individual peoples and names. So we're not talking about Tumukwas, but we can talk about Satoriba. We can talk about, so we can say Powhatan, and that name has sort of like a connotation. We kind of have an idea, even perhaps it's wrong, but Uncas, I don't know. I'm just thinking of,
sure.
But I think beginning to populate these stories with people and and dates even that are not sort of Eurocentric are so important. For me, when I was looking at this, I'm like, oh gosh, this Native rebellion is actually far more important than this other date that I have about when the Spanish set up shop in Appalachia. So thinking about that chronology, sort of broadening and adding to that chronology and adding to the list of players. And really thinking about I think early America has really grown in Native history, has really sort of, it's one of the most booming and most exciting parts of early American history, in my opinion, right now. And I think this is an area that still needs so much work. So I hope it just attracts. I've seen stuff on the Shawnee, really exciting things on the Shawnee recently. And I keep hoping, keep coming south. And I think there's just lots of really great work on 19th century Cherokee and Choctaw and sort of that thinks about removal and what it means for. And I think there's a really interesting earlier story about these communities and these peoples and these languages. So I think there's a lot to be done in sort of tracing that further back and thinking about that. So I'm hoping it stays. I mean, I see it's sort of a booming era, obviously, forward in time. But I hope that by at least me giving names and people and dates, I open up. I hope that this is not the end. I hope someone says, she only talks for one page about this rebellion. This is not okay. Like, I'm like, yes, go do your work on that. I have rebellions, entire rebellion no one has ever written on. I have sources like this. I'm like, I always talk about them. I'm like, you want to write about the Appalachian Rebellion? I can give you everything I have. Because that's my hope. That's what I would love to see.
So, I mean, given the fact that this world is maybe distant and foreign to us in the historical profession and the public, this would not be the first book that people would say, oh, here's a book with something to say about today's world, today's digital network world of instant communication. And that communication producing just troves of data around which there's this big debate over who accesses it and how. A couple years ago, when you were putting the finishing touches on this book or in some part of the process of this book, you penned an op-ed in Al Jazeera actually making that case in the context of these fights around private data, I think, and data collection. What is that case to be made about what this book can tell us about some of our communication debates today?
Yeah. So, I mean, for me, this book comes in 2016 because I exist in 2016, because I'm on Twitter and I'm on Facebook and I think about information every day. And I, you know, I use Google, I use Wikipedia. So I think it's not, I didn't write this in a vacuum thinking, oh, I'm such a genius to think about information as a priority. I think about it as a priority because I exist in this moment of time. So I'm curious about, if this was an issue or this was, and I think my biggest surprise was that in fact, people thought a great deal about information, in earlier moments of time. And I think for me, the takeaway lesson is that there's lots of complaints as governments try to make decisions about peoples and regions they know little about, and they're trying to make policies on them. They say, well, it was imperfect. We had imperfect information. And I think, well, let me tell you about decision making with imperfect information. So I think for me, it was seeing a world in which people understood that they had rather imperfect information, but they were trying to do things not to make it more perfect, but to make it legible for themselves. So I think for me that the takeaway story is that technology is not the whole answer. Because here part of the reason why the brackets of my book is because I wanted to tell a story of information that wasn't about technology, that wasn't about, well, here comes the printing press and here comes, you know, the mail and here comes, you know, Google that's going to give you this chronology. I wanted to tell this sort of moment of time where that's not the sort of technology is not going to be the thing that's going to revolutionize the story. So if it's not going to be more Twitter feeds or more, you know, or more access to the internet that's going to sort of revolution. So it's not technology that's the drive of the story. It's thinking about how people process and make decisions with information. And I think that for me is a takeaway that although we often tend to talk about information in very abstract ways, we tend to give information lots of agency. News moves freely and things like that. I think that is really dangerous. I think we're forgetting the human element and human decision making that comes in what news moves to who and how. And I think for me, that's the historian in me always looks at that when things move freely. I go, no, you know, who moved them? Who created that? You know, and I think that that's a really important reminder is that this, in fact, although it seems to be we live in an information age and a technology age, we still live in a human age. We still live in a people age. And making sense that, and technology is a reflection of our limits and our abilities. It doesn't exist beyond people. It shows you what we can do, what we can think of. So I think that for me is a takeaway, is thinking about the human element in information and not that it exists aside of it. In the colonial world, it's rather easy, right? Because it has to be face-to-face or it has to be based on a human interaction. So I'm more reminded of that than we are perhaps today when we sort of send a tweet. But I think about that all the time.
So I know you just finished this incredible book. It's an achievement. You deserve rest and celebration. But before I let you go, I wanted to ask a bit about what you're working on next, and I'm particularly intrigued that you are dabbling in archaeology, perhaps.
Yes.
So I'm wondering if, before we end our discussion today, if you can tell us a little bit about what you're up to.
Yeah, so I think I'm going to lose my historian card of residence because I'm dabbling. I'm having affairs with other disciplines, as I like to say. I'm having a fling. So I've been thinking. One of the projects I've been thinking a lot is about archaeology. I inadvertently found an archaeological collection that Yale had in the Peabody Museum that really opened up a story about sort of South Florida, and that really threw me. As a historian of the American South, I've had the privilege of always engaging with archaeology, but never had the responsibility of beginning with archaeology. Linguistics always served as a way to supplement my story. And here I was faced with a primarily non-written archive, and how do I, as a historian trained to read documents, make sense of it? So I think the methodological problem interests me as much as the field and the findings themselves. So I think that, and hopefully all these new projects, these side projects, these flings are all collaborative. I'm deeply, deeply, deeply a believer in collaborative research. I am not an archaeologist. I am a historian who thinks deeply about it, but I don't have a PhD in archaeology. I don't know the archaeology historiography. So I depend on collaborative research. So this endeavor is going to be done alongside a team. I'm hoping I'm going to be digging this summer alongside a team, and all done is that in collaboration. So to say I'm an interdisciplinary scholar, I'm barely an I strive to be one. So that's one thing that I'm doing, is sort of thinking through archaeology, South Florida, and then whatever they allow me to keep doing and thinking through. And then also a linguistic project, thinking through the Tumuqua language with Aaron Broadwell, who's at the University of Florida, who's just fantastic. And he's the premier linguistics on Tumuqua. And so working with him through these texts, and me knowing the history, him knowing the linguistics, has been just opening my mind to what these documents can reveal. But those are like the side projects in terms of my own personal intellectual historical project. I'm thinking of exploring the War of Spanish Succession, or Queen Anne's War, so the period between 1702 and 1713. I know that sounds very narrow, especially when I've just done a book that's like 300 years. But it's really thinking about all these isolated moments of time, and thinking about how they come together, thinking about the slave raids, thinking about the attacks, all these little incidents and how they can be grouped together and what that can tell us about maybe perhaps a continental history and Atlantic history. I don't really know. It's really way too early.
Well, that sounds like three really fruitful directions to go after this.
Too many.
I've been talking with Alejandra Dubkowski. She's the author of Informed Power, Communication in the Early American South. It's just out from Harvard University Press. Thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you so much.
You've been listening to my conversation with Alejandra Dubkowski, Associate Professor of History at Yale and author of Informed Power, Communication in the Early American South from Harvard University Press. You can listen to all of the past interviews at newbooksinnativeamericanstudies.com or through iTunes free of charge. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter at newbooksnatam. For the New Books Network, I'm Andrew Epstein. Thanks so much for listening.